Good morning and welcome to the Acromegaly Update for Monday, May 4th, 2026. I'm your host, and today we have two substantial papers from the last week, both published on April 29th, that together give us a sharp, up-to-date look at where acromegaly care stands in 2026. Let's get into it. First up, a review article in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism from Divya Yogi Morin at Cleveland Clinic and Philippe Chanson at the Université Paris-Saclay in France. The title is simply Diagnosis of Acromegaly, and while that might sound like a familiar topic, this review is packed with fresh thinking that reflects how much the diagnostic landscape has changed. The core problem the authors are grappling with is one that hasn't changed much. Patients with acromegaly still wait an average of 6 to 10 years before they get the right diagnosis. That's a long time. And the reason isn't hard to understand. Many patients don't present with the classic textbook picture of enlarged hands and coarsened facial features. Instead, they come in complaining of sleep apnea or carpal tunnel syndrome or joint pain or metabolic problems. These are incredibly common symptoms, and they don't automatically make a clinician think of a pituitary tumor producing excess growth hormone. So what can we do about it? Yogi Morin and Chanson are excited about two overlapping areas. The first is artificial intelligence. Comorbidity cluster analysis, using AI to recognize patterns across a patient's symptom and lab history, may flag at-risk patients for biochemical testing before anyone has visually identified the classic features. AI-driven facial recognition tools are also being studied and show real promise for early identification, particularly in populations where access to endocrinology specialists is limited. The second area of progress is in the biochemistry itself. The authors describe meaningful advances in assay harmonization, basically getting laboratories around the world to produce comparable growth hormone and IGF-1 measurements, and in the establishment of robust, age-adjusted reference ranges for IGF-1. That matters because IGF-1 remains the preferred first-line screening test. It's stable, it reflects integrated growth hormone secretion over time, and it's practical to measure. But its interpretation is nuanced. Age, sex, body weight, diabetes, liver disease, pregnancy, and estrogen exposure can all shift IGF-1 levels in ways that have nothing to do with acromegaly. When the biochemical picture is ambiguous, confirmatory testing involves measuring growth hormone during an oral glucose tolerance test. And here's a noteworthy update. With the advent of ultrasensitive GH assays, the recommended nadir cutoff for growth hormone suppression has dropped to approximately 0.4 micrograms per liter. That's a stricter threshold than many centers were using before. And the authors are careful to note that the specific assay being used matters. This isn't a one-size-fits-all number. Rounding out the review is a discussion of imaging advances, including high-resolution MRI and PET MRI, as well as radiomics approaches that may allow more precise tumor characterization. Taken together, this paper is a solid state-of-the-art resource for anyone involved in diagnosing or screening for acromegaly. Now, our second paper shifts from diagnosis to what happens after, managing the complications of acromegaly over the long haul. This comes from the journal Pituitary and represents the output of the 16th Acromegaly Consensus Conference held in September 2024. The lead author is Andrea Giustina from San Raffaele in Milan, and the author list reads like a who's who of international acromegaly expertise. 43 specialists from across Europe, the Americas, and Australia contributed. What were they updating? The 2020 Acromegaly Comorbidity Management Guidelines. In the years since, new evidence has emerged on both familiar complications and some that weren't as well characterized before. The cardiovascular effects of chronic growth hormone excess, the metabolic disturbances, particularly glucose dysregulation, the skeletal complications, including vertebral fractures, the increased cancer risk, all of these domains got a fresh look. One area of particular focus was how the choice of medical therapy affects comorbidity management. This is increasingly important because treatment decisions are no longer just about biochemical control. Pasireotide, for instance, is a potent second-generation somatostatin receptor ligand that achieves biochemical control in patients who don't respond adequately to first-generation agents, but it carries a significant risk of hyperglycemia. So if a patient already has diabetes or is at high risk for it, that has to factor into the treatment algorithm. The consensus provides updated guidance on exactly these kinds of pharmacological trade-offs. On the horizon, the panel also considered how emerging agents, oral somatostatin receptor ligands, and combination regimens are likely to reshape practice. Paltusotine, the oral somatostatin analog, was on the radar as an agent with an evolving evidence base. What ties these two papers together is a sense of momentum in the field. The diagnosis problem is being attacked from new angles: AI, better assays, and stricter criteria. The treatment problem is being approached with growing sophistication, matching drug choices to individual comorbidity profiles rather than defaulting to a one-size-fits-all protocol. The next frontier is probably the integration of these two advances, identifying patients earlier, before the comorbidity burden accumulates, and intervening with agents that achieve tight biochemical control without creating new problems. That's the goal, and the research community is clearly moving toward it. That's a wrap for today's acromegaly update. Two solid papers this week, a thin week by volume, but not by quality. We'll be back tomorrow with the latest. Take care.